Hi, welcome to Mosaics, a podcast of the Idaho Office for Refugees. I'm your host, Holly Beach. And I know at this time, a lot of us have had questions about immigration, about policies, about any changes that we can expect in the future administration. So I'm here today with an immigration attorney who hopefully can help answer some of our questions and provide some education. I'm here with Chris Christensen. He is an attorney here in Boise. And Chris founded Christensen Legal in Boise in 2017, but has been doing this work long before that. So welcome to Mosaics, Chris.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, Holly.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Before we jump into any of the details, I just want to give people a chance to get to know you a little bit better, who you are, where you grew up, and what brought you to immigration law.
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Caldwell and had a lot of Hispanic friends growing up and actually started learning Spanish as soon as I was able to in the Caldwell School District, which was about eighth grade. And so I continued with Spanish throughout high school and then went to Willamette for college and got a triple major in politics, economics, and Spanish and a minor in philosophy and had the opportunity to do a study abroad program in Spain. And that's really where I solidified my Spanish. And after graduating from law school, I managed a Mexican food restaurant in Caldwell and continued to work on my Spanish and continued to meet good, hardworking immigrants who wanted to provide better opportunities for their future generations and were working very hard in jobs that typically people in the U.S. didn't necessarily want. Prior to going to law school, I had the opportunity to be an academic advisor for the CAMP program, the College Assistance Migrant Program at the University of Idaho. And that's a federally funded scholarship program for first-generation college students whose parents have worked in the field a sufficient number of days. And every student who came to that program wrote a story about why they were there and how they got there. And really what struck me about those stories was it was like classic American success story after American success story, meaning kids would say, my parents worked hard. They worked in the fields. They toiled day after day. We didn't have a lot of money, but they always stressed to me that education was the path forward. It was the way to get out of the farm work, the field work. And those students really attributed that hard work of their parents to them being in college. And so that really helped me solidify my desire to become an immigration attorney.
What year did you start with your first year as an immigration attorney? What was that?
That was in 2009.
And what were you initially doing as you started your career?
Well, I went to work for a firm that used to be in Boise, Andrade Legal, and I immediately inherited a caseload of about 85 cases, and it was a little overwhelming initially because I knew that people were coming to me to help me navigate a very complex system and trusting me with their family and with their livelihood and their future in the United States. And so it was a lot of late nights and a lot of weekends. And there were a few times I was on the phone with my parents in tears, wondering what I'd gotten myself into. But I learned pretty quickly what I needed to know in order to be a competent immigration attorney and be able to help people.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's such an amazing skill. It's such a tangible way to help someone in a vulnerable time of their life. A lot of times, you know, my response has to be like, oh, you need to talk to a legal professional. I'm not credentialed to give that kind of advice. And you get to do it. You get to help them make that real difference and that real change in their life. This is a big question, but what are some of the things about our immigration system in the U.S. that people might not understand that you would like to see more understanding around?
I just think that in general, it is an incredibly complex system, and I wish people appreciated how difficult it is. Many people don't have a line to wait in that will get them status. Many people are fleeing life or death situations or fleeing situations where they think their children will have no life or no future or perhaps be killed. And so looking at immigration with compassion, looking at it through a lens of it is very complicated, and also truly understanding that this nation was built by immigrants. Unless you are a Native American, you are an immigrant. And part of the reason I believe this nation is such an amazing country is because of the hard work of immigrants, people who came here to provide better opportunities for their future generations.
Yeah, and we don't have to go very far back in our line of relatives, unless you are indigenous here, to see when and why your loved ones or your, the people who came before you chose to come. I know in one branch of my family, it was they saw the writing on the wall that their religion was going to be persecuted, and they made the move. And at that time in the 1800s, there wasn't a big complicated system or process or barriers. It was possible for them to do that and continue to farm and not be persecuted. And it's same desires that we see in people today, but different system.
Absolutely. The system in part is so complicated because we haven't had comprehensive immigration reform for many, many years. And so typically what we get is piecemeal legislation that's often passed in reaction to some world event. And it makes for a very discombobulated and difficult system to understand.
So as we enter into the new administration in January, what are some things that maybe we can learn from the past 4 years and from the years ahead of that, that we can take forward to help us, you know, understand what we might be expecting? We don't want to speculate on things that might happen, but there's some understanding historically that we can build upon. What are you looking at when it comes to learning from the past about what we can expect?
Well, I think it's important for immigrants to understand that regardless of their legal status, that they have rights in this great country. You have the right to talk to a lawyer. You have the right to refuse to answer questions that might incriminate yourself. And so understanding that everybody has rights, and it may be important to assert those rights, to protect those rights. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of fear right now in immigrant communities, and my response to that is, please don't panic. This is a country where immigration is of a founding principle, and immigrants will continue to be important to this economy and to the future of the United States. I want immigrants to know that they are welcome here. They do have a home. And I do think it is important to understand that priorities will shift with the new administration. One of the big things that I anticipate will happen relatively quickly, based on the prior administration, the prior Trump administration, is that our current system of three tiers of priorities for removal will very likely, if not certainly, go away, maybe as soon as January 20th. And it will be replaced by a system that essentially says anyone who is vulnerable to deportation, anyone without status, or anyone who has a crime that may make them removable, is a priority. And so while the message should be, do not give up hope and you have a place and protect your rights, this is also a time to minimize risk for those communities that may be vulnerable.
What are the three tiers currently of priority?
Currently, the number one tier is those folks who may be a national security concern. Specific convictions might put somebody in that first tier. Second tier is really related to dates of arrival, recent entrance being a higher priority. And then third tier, if I'm not mistaken, is related to folks with some sort of fraud or misrepresentation in their history. Mm-hmm. The priorities that we currently have are somewhat similar to the priorities that we had under the Obama administration. And they really dictate to agencies like ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and CBP, Customs and Border Protection, where to focus the limited priorities. Mm-hmm. Because the reality of it is, there is a very large undocumented population in the United States. the government doesn't have the funds, the resources to remove all of those people. And I think most of society would agree that it doesn't make sense to deport the hardworking farm worker who has no criminal record and who has a family full of U.S. citizen children, who pays taxes and contributes, who goes to the local church every Sunday.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to even imagine that, or the anxiety of living with that. For I know for us and our partners that we work with, a lot of our partners serve both people who came through refugee-specific status, and then others work with people who came through another way of immigration. Mm-hmm. And the refugee-specific status, it's mind-blowing to me how limited that pathway is for the. We're living in a time, unfortunately, of the greatest number of displaced people this world has ever seen. And for the number of people who qualify for refugee status, which are those who have been persecuted or fear persecution based on simple factors of who they are, that, you know, their religion, their political opinion, their social group. So those people who are able to seek refugee status, less than 1% are able to go through the process that allows them to resettle in that third country that welcomes them as refugees, provides that permanent pathway to citizenship, and then where they can rebuild their life. So that is, I mean, we're so thankful for everyone who has had an opportunity to live safely and provide for their families, which is what we all want, but it's so narrow, and we have so many other community members that don't have that security of that refugee status. We have been trying to reassure people who did come through the refugee program, like, hey, you might be hearing things, you might not quite understand what these proposed policies will mean for you or your family, but that is a permanent pathway to citizenship here. So hopefully can help put some of those fears to rest and bring some comfort there, even though it's uncertain times. What are some other steps that people can take, though, you had mentioned, you know, to minimize risk, there's some things that you can do if you are in, like, maybe a mixed status family, or if you're uncertain about the future of the status that you have. What are some steps that you can take to help prepare yourself?
Absolutely. Well, my overarching message I would like to be, do not panic. And do not believe everything that you see in the media. It is important to be realistic, and enforcement will increase. And taking some concrete steps can both give people a little bit of peace of mind, as well as be prepared for the worst case scenario. So I think families, mixed status families, should collect identity documents, birth certificates, passports, check the expirations on those documents that might expire, like a passport, and renew them. Those documents should be kept in a secure location where everybody in the family knows where that location is. Within that packet of documents, it might be wise to include an emergency plan. Who do we call in case our loved one is picked up? Maybe including a power of attorney. There are both financial power of attorneys. Be very careful who you trust with that power, but also powers of attorney that would allow someone to make decisions about your children, decisions for perhaps medical care or education. Nobody wants to think about being separated from a loved one, but the fear is already there. And again, having a plan, taking concrete steps to be prepared, can help put your mind at ease a little bit in case that worst case scenario does come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. What would be your, vision that you see in America in terms of how we approach the immigration discussion?
That's a very, very tough question, but I think a good one. I don't think open borders are a realistic solution. I don't think that's a system that will work. But I would like to see comprehensive immigration reform, perhaps that allowed pathway to legal status for those who are already here. Maybe it could be a big fundraiser for our government that could help us chip away at the deficit by perhaps charging those people. Most of them would be happy to pay. I would like to see an increase in the number of refugees who are admitted to the United States. We have a bounty of blessings in this country, and unless you've been abroad and perhaps seen what a third world country or a favela or a ghetto looks like, you may not appreciate that. Immigrants, you look at any legitimate study, and immigrants are a net gain, a net benefit economically. They do jobs that unfortunately many people are unwilling to do. I was a migrant farm worker attorney in Indiana for 2 years, and I traveled the state going to migrant farm worker labor camps and talking to workers about their rights. And I met with thousands of workers, and over the 2 years that I did that, I met two Caucasian-born domestic U.S. citizen farm workers. Everyone else was an immigrant. They were working 10, 12-hour days in 80-degree, 85-degree heat with 85% humidity, detasseling corn, picking tomatoes, back-breaking labor. Everybody loves to go to the store and buy tomatoes for $2 a pound and milk for $3 a gallon. The reason we can do that is because of the hard work of immigrants.
Yeah, talk about a need for reform. We need labor reform too. It's just, yeah, with gratitude for the work being done, also sadness for the conditions, and then it's like accepted. So that, yeah, that is definitely an area that needs reform too, so that these crucial, critical workers have recourse and rights. And yeah, but I do see what you're saying. It's vital. I think I saw a study that I think almost half of people growing food in this country don't have immigration papers. So, you know, you think about realistically what would happen, and it's, you can't stand without that. So it's very important work in families and lives and cultures that I just want to see peace. And I agree with you about what you said.
In Idaho specifically, the dairy industry is a huge percentage of the workers in the dairy industry are undocumented laborers. And while there are serious flaws with our guest worker programs and abuses like the H-2A, in part, the dairy industry has such a large undocumented workforce because they're not eligible for H-2A workers. Mm. And so while that system could use some reform and some added labor protections, I think in general, we would be very surprised at what milk costs a gallon if there wasn't that undocumented workforce, or if we could even buy it at all.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk specifically about some of the, you know, policies or changes that came up during the previous President Trump administration and what has been floated already for what's next. And something that's commonly called the Muslim ban has come up. Can you explain what that was last time? Mm-hmm. If it was, you know, like any court challenges or what we might expect on that front?
Yeah, so it was colloquially called the Muslim ban, but it was actually a ban of seven specific countries who happen to be predominantly Muslim countries. And essentially, nationals or citizens of those countries could not enter the U.S. unless they happened to be permanent residents or U.S. citizens. And that ban took effect very rapidly, and there was a lot of chaos in airports, people with existing visas being turned away, uncertainty initially about whether lawful permanent residents were an exception and could be admitted, lots of people stuck in airports, turned away. It was fairly chaotic. It was ultimately challenged in court, and it made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court upheld it. It did not strike down that ban based on presidential power. And so it was an interesting case study. I taught the immigration case at the University of Idaho College of Law fall of 2022, and it was one of the cases we read, and it was very interesting.
I wasn't working at Idaho Office of Refugees at that time. Do you remember if that ban impacted people in the refugee resettlement pipeline from those countries as well?
I believe it did, but I am not entirely positive, Holly.
Okay. And yeah, historically, I know we have a national, for refugee resettlement specifically, there is a nationally set kind of cap every year for what the U.S. is committing to resettle and what regions people are from, allocations. Mm-hmm. So we were seeing a steady number nationally until it hit historic lows during the previous Trump administration. And it was also that's when COVID happened. But I believe nationally it got down to below 12,000 total nationwide, which is historically low. This past fiscal year, it, thanks to the help of a lot of private sponsors too, who are joining together as citizens and saying, we'll sponsor a refugee, we'll raise the money, we'll do all the resettlement work. That program is seeing momentum, which is really cool to see the community buy-in to wanting this program. It was over 100,000 total nationwide last fiscal year for the first time in like 30 years. So, you know, we see the desire and the value of offering refuge to people who are persecuted, and seeing that in our own generations back, and wanting to either maybe a faith conviction or just a humanitarian conviction of it's the right thing to do. So, you know, it takes a long time to build that momentum kind of up and to have the infrastructure in place. And what are you looking at the future in terms of the refugee resettlement program and what any expectations there, or is that a little bit more out of your lane?
It's a little more out of my lane in that there are excellent organizations like the Idaho Office for Refugees and Agency for New Americans and the International Rescue Committee that are actively involved in resettling refugees. It's something I'm aware of just because I'm an immigration attorney and all of the news I watch is related to immigration. And I anticipate under the prior Trump administration, there was a suspension of the refugee program for a while. The president has the unilateral authority to set the number of refugees. And so I anticipate the number will be set lower. I think in the year you were alluding to where there were about 12,000 entries, the number actually was set at 30 or 35, but in part because of the suspension, perhaps in part because of COVID, that number wasn't actually fulfilled. But I think the number will be set lower. And I think in general, legal immigration, including through the refugee pathways, will slow down for the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to kind of bring this back home, you know, you've worked really hard. You work very hard, and there's a lot of work to be done. You've worked with our office for the past couple of years, I believe. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had the benefit of doing a whole lot of work on Afghan applications, Afghan asylum applications. And the situation in Afghanistan is incredibly tragic, and my office filed 129 affirmative Afghan asylum applications, and these were people that the vast majority of whom the government evacuated out of Afghanistan. They were given a special kind of parole under a category called OAW, Operation Allies Welcome. Mm-hmm. And they came to the U.S. because, for the most part, they had served either the former Afghan government, our ally, or worked with U.S. interest. And those things put a target on their back for the Taliban. It has been both some of the most rewarding and yet some of the most challenging work that I've done. In 2024 alone, I represented over 40 applicants during their asylum interview. Idaho's unique in that we're under the jurisdiction of the Chicago Asylum Office, and so an adjudicator will fly out from Chicago, do a week of interviews, usually three a day, so about 15 a week. It made for some really, really busy weeks. The longest interview I had was over 4 hours. Most of them were two and a half, 3 hours. Even though I've been doing immigration since 2009, this was the first time I'd ever seen an asylum officer, an adjudicator, somebody trained in asylum law, break down in tears during one of those interviews. And it happened not just once, but twice. And that's simply because the stories were that powerful and because the Taliban really is that terrible.
Mm. And that, so without the asylum pathway, they're here on temporary status and at risk of being sent back to a very dangerous place?
Absolutely. They were, generally speaking, given 2 years of humanitarian parole, and then there was an ability to extend that for another 2 years, much like what is happening with the Ukrainians currently arriving in what we call the U4U, Uniting for Ukraine program. Once that parole status ends, you need some other status. Now, right now, that could be temporary protected status. There are open registration periods for Ukrainians and for Afghans. If you arrive by a certain date and you register by a certain date, you're protected with TPS. But we don't know if TPS will be extended. It's designated on an 18-month basis, and again, at the discretion of the president. There was some movement and a lot of talk on Capitol Hill for an Afghan Adjustment Act. Adjustment is the legal process of getting your green card or lawful permanent residence here in the United States. And while I thought it was a very good idea and it was in the news for quite a while, it ultimately wasn't ever passed. And I think in part, the American public has very strong opinions about immigration, and in general, the system is complicated enough. I don't think most people understand how it works or what legitimate options somebody may have.
Yeah, it's extremely complicated. I'm still learning. I'm so thankful for people like you that are working in it and really, yeah, like I said, making such a tangible difference in somebody's life. I know it's painful work at times, but I know you also have, like you said, the high highs. What is something, a joy or a hope that keeps you going?
It's the profound thanks that I get. Sometimes that can be a hug. Sometimes that's a home-cooked meal. Sometimes that's a beautiful embroidered thing from somebody's native country. That's really why I do this. Because it is very stressful, and I have 3 kids at home, and I don't spend as much time with them as I'd like. But it is that human connection, the life-altering impact that I can have to better somebody's life, that keeps me doing this. The Afghan cases are a classic example. Not too long ago, my office took on a pro bono case for a deported veteran, somebody who'd served in the military, honorably discharged after a tour in Iraq, significant PTSD, came back, had some problems with the law, and was deported. We were able to get him not only back into the United States, but to help him become a U.S. citizen. It's that life-altering trajectory and the profound thanks that I get at the end of the day from those folks that keeps me going.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Chris.
You're welcome.
Is there anything else that you would like to leave us with today?
Just that I firmly believe this great nation is the country it is today, is the world leader, because we've set an example and we've had open arms and we've welcomed immigrants. Unless you were born in this country as a Native American, you or your generations, prior generations, came here as immigrants. And there is not only a lot of value in diversity, diverse thought, diversity of culture, but the vast majority of immigrants come here to work hard or to escape persecution. They're coming here because they feel like they don't have a choice, or they're coming here because they want to give a better life to their future generations. And I would like all of us to think about our own immigrant history and to be more welcoming of the stranger.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for this opportunity, Holly.
Thank you for joining the conversation. For more information on how to be involved with refugee resettlement, please visit idahorefugees.org. Mosaics is produced by the Idaho Office for Refugees with grant support from the M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust. Music by the Afrosonics. Production in partnership with SB Studios.